The Catra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Catra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're trying to cut through some of the noise, you know, the jargon you hear in financial news.
Yeah, bring it down to earth a bit.
Exactly. We want to give you the essential tools to really understand the economy around you. We're diving deep into Felipe Lorraine B's book, Macroeconomics, The Essential Knowledge and Policy Tools. It's, well, pretty indispensable, I think.
Absolutely. And if you've been, like, paying attention to the news lately, all the talk about inflation, jobs, interest rates going up and down.
It feels chaotic, right?
Totally. And Lorraine really starts there. He tackles this feeling that modern economies are just too complex, too inaccessible for the average person to grasp.
It's true. Macroeconomics often gets this reputation, you know, of being all abstract equations.
Dry stuff.
Yeah. But Lorraine argues it's actually some of the most practical knowledge you can have. It's the basic framework for understanding, well, everything that shapes your daily life.
Like whether you can find a job or what your savings are actually worth.
Right. Or even what your community might look like decades from now, your standard of living.
And he really pushes this idea of economic literacy as almost a civic duty, not just for economists.
So you can actually understand what leaders are doing, hold them accountable.
Exactly. And make better decisions for yourself financially, too. It empowers you.
Okay, so let's talk about the author for a second, Felipe Lorraine B. Because his background is, well, it's pretty unusual.
It really is.
Yeah.
On one hand, he's definitely a top-tier academic, got his PhD from Harvard, co-wrote a major textbook with Jeffrey Sachs.
Yeah.
You know, the whole nine yards, academic credentials, check.
But then there's the other half, and this is what makes his view so unique, I think.
Right. He wasn't just in an ivory tower. He served as Chile's Minister of Finance, not once, but twice.
Wow, twice. So he went from theory, from the whiteboard.
Yeah. To the hot seat. Yeah, actually managing national budgets, setting tax policy, dealing with massive global crises as they happened in real time.
That's invaluable experience. He wasn't just watching it happen. He was applying the theory under intense political pressure.
And dealing with all the messy stuff like institutional roadblocks, global capital suddenly flowing out, or huge swings in commodity prices, especially coming from an emerging market perspective, like Chile.
So that mixed the academic rigor plus that hard-won practical policy experience.
Right.
That's what makes the book special, right?
Totally. It tells you not just how the economic models should work in theory,
but where they kind of break down in the real world or how politics messes things up.
Exactly. Pragmatism meets theory.
So that's the author. What about the book itself? What's the core message, the big idea?
Lorraine really frames macroeconomics as this essential toolkit, but not just for economists, for everyone, for civic empowerment.
Okay, so demystifying it, cutting through the jargon so regular people can understand.
Precisely. Arming the citizen with knowledge. And he lays it out really logically.
How so?
Well, first, he starts with the basics. How do we even measure the economy's health? That's the measurement part. He focuses on what he calls the big three.
Ah, the vital signs. GDP, inflation, and unemployment.
You got it. Then, once you know how to measure, you look at the dynamics. This covers sort of two big stories.
Okay.
The long-term story of economic growth, you know, why some countries get rich and others stay poor. And then the short-term drama, the business cycle.
The booms and busts we always hear about.
Right. Using things like aggregate demand and supply to understand those ups and downs.
And after understanding the problems, the fluctuations.
Then comes policy. What can we actually do about it? He explores the two main levers governments and central banks pull.
Fiscal policy, that's taxes and spending, right?
Yep. And monetary policy, which is mostly about the central bank managing interest rates. And he puts it all in the context of, well, today's globalized world. You can't ignore that.
Makes sense. So let's dig into that first part, measurement. GDP comes up constantly.
It does. And Lorraine defines it clearly. The total value of all final goods and services produced. He often uses that expenditure formula, C plus I plus G plus NX.
Consumption, investment, government spending, net exports. Basically, who's buying what?
Exactly. It's the accounting. But here's the really critical bit he emphasizes. The difference between nominal GDP and real GDP.
Okay, explain that.
Nominal GDP uses today's prices. So if prices just go up inflation, nominal GDP goes up too, even if we didn't actually produce more stuff.
Ah, so it looks like growth, but it might just be inflation.
Precisely. Real GDP adjusts for those price changes. It uses constant prices from a base year. So real GDP growth tells you if we actually produced more goods and services. It's the true measure of output growth.
That's a huge distinction. Like, if a politician boasts about 6% GDP growth,
your first question should be, was that nominal or real? And what was inflation? If inflation was, say, 7%, then real GDP actually shrank by 1%.
Got it. So real GDP is key. And that leads us to inflation itself, measured by the CPI, the Consumer Price Index.
Right. And Lorraine stresses the real costs of high inflation. It's not just that things cost more.
Well,
it creates massive uncertainty. Businesses can't plan long-term investments if they don't know what their costs or revenues will be in real terms. Consumers might delay big purchases.
And it hurts people on fixed incomes, right? Like retirees.
Absolutely. It erodes their purchasing power. It kind of arbitrarily redistributes wealth in unfair ways. So keeping prices stable isn't just some academic goal. It's about economic fairness and predictability.
Okay, that covers measuring the current health. What about the long game economic growth?
This is where things get really interesting. Lorraine points out how even small differences in annual growth rates, say 2% versus 4%, lead to enormous gaps in wealth between countries over generations.
Because it compounds over time.
Exactly. It's like compound interest, but for a whole nation's standard of living.
And what drives that long run growth? Is it just building more factories or having more workers?
That helps. But it's not the main engine, according to Lorraine and, well, most economists now. The really crucial factor is productivity, especially something called total factor productivity, or TFP.
TFP, what exactly is that? Sounds a bit technical.
Think of it like this. Adding more workers or more machines, that's adding more inputs. TFP is about getting more output from the same inputs. It's about working smarter, not just harder.
So innovation,
yeah.
Technology, better ways of organizing things.
All of that. It's the efficiency boost that comes from new ideas. Technological progress, better management, smoother processes. It's the secret sauce, really, like inventing the assembly line or the microchip.
Okay, so TFP is key for long-run prosperity, but what allows TFP to flourish?
This is maybe one of the most important points. Institutions. Lorraine really hammers this home.
What kind of institutions?
Things like secure property rights, knowing your investment won't just be taken away. The rule of law. Predictable legal systems, contracts being enforced, stable, reasonably uncorrupt government.
So the underlying rules of the game.
Exactly. They provide the incentives. Why would anyone risk their capital on a long-term investment or innovate if they can't trust the system to protect their efforts and their potential profits?
Yeah.
Good institutions are the bedrock.
That makes sense. So that's the long, slow grind of growth. But economies don't just grow smoothly, right? They have these ups and downs.
No, they definitely don't. Which brings us to the business cycle, the expansions, the peaks, the recessions, the troughs.
Mm-hmm.
And the main tool Lorraine gives us to understand why these happen is the aggregate demand and aggregate supply framework, ADS.
Okay, ADSS. How does that help explain things like, say, the 2008 crash?
Well, the 2008 global financial crisis was a classic example of a massive negative shock to aggregate demand. Suddenly, confidence just evaporated. Banks stopped lending, businesses stopped investing, people stopped spending. AD shifted sharply to the left.
Leading to recession and high unemployment.
Exactly. Now, contrast that with something like the oil price shocks in the 1970s.
That was different, wasn't it? Stagflation.
Right. Oil is a key input for almost everything. When its price suddenly quadrupled, it hit aggregate supply. It became much more expensive for the economy to produce goods and services. As shifted left.
And that gave us that nasty mix of stagnation, falling output, rising unemployment, and high inflation.
Precisely. So the ADS model helps us diagnose the source of the problem, which is critical for figuring out the right policy response.
Which brings us to the policy toolkit. Let's start with fiscal policy. That's the government's role, right? Spending and taxes.
Yep. Governed by the Treasury or Ministry of Finance. During a downturn, the government can try to boost aggregate demand by, say, increasing its own spending, G, on infrastructure or other projects, or by cutting taxes, T, to leave more money in people's pockets.
And this spending has knock-on effects, doesn't it? The multiplier effect.
Exactly. If the government builds a bridge, the construction workers get paid. They then spend that money on groceries, clothes, maybe a car repair.
And the grocery store owner, the mechanic, they then have more income.
Which they spend, and so on. That initial government spending ripples through the economy, potentially generating a larger total increase in GDP than the original amount spent. That's the multiplier.
Sounds powerful, but what's the catch? There's always a catch, right?
Huh, yeah. The main trade-off with fiscal policy, especially increased spending or tax cuts, is national debt. The government usually has to borrow money to fund this stimulus.
And too much government borrowing can be a problem.
It can. Rain discusses the risk of crowding out. If the government borrows huge amounts, it increases the overall demand for loans, which can push up interest rates for everyone.
Making it more expensive for private businesses to borrow and invest?
Potentially, yes. So the government stimulus might inadvertently dampen private investment. It's a balancing act.
Okay, so that's fiscal policy. What about the other big tool, monetary policy? This is the central bank's job, like the Federal Reserve in the U.S.
Right. Usually central banks are designed to be independent from the day-to-day political pressures. Their main goals are typically twofold: keeping inflation low and stable, price stability, and promoting maximum sustainable employment.
And their main weapon is the policy interest rate, right? Like the Fed funds rate.
That's the primary tool. By adjusting this short-term interest rate, they influence borrowing costs throughout the economy.
How does that work? Lowering rates stimulates things.
Generally, yes. Lower rates make it cheaper for businesses to borrow for investment and for consumers to borrow for houses or cars. This tends to boost aggregate demand.
And raising rates does the opposite, puts the brakes on.
Exactly. If inflation is getting too high, they raise rates to cool down spending and borrowing.
Now, Lorraine also touches on what happened after 2008 when interest rates basically hit zero. They ran out of room, right?
They did. Traditional monetary policy lost its effectiveness. That's when central banks turned to unconventional tools, most famously quantitative easing or QE.
QE, that's when the central bank buys assets directly.
Right. Instead of just targeting the short-term rate, they started buying massive amounts of longer-term government bonds and sometimes other assets. The idea was to directly inject liquidity into the financial system and push down long-term interest rates to encourage lending and investment.
A pretty extraordinary measure.
Born out of an extraordinary crisis. And it has big implications we're still grappling with today.
So pulling this all together, Lorraine emphasizes some key themes that run through all of this, doesn't he?
He does. One big one is just the reality of the inescapable trade-offs of policymaking.
Meaning you can't have it all?
Pretty much. Macroeconomics is often about managing conflicting goals. The classic example is the short-run trade-off between unemployment and inflation. Policies to quickly boost jobs might ignite inflation, and policies to slam the brakes on inflation might cost jobs.
So when politicians promise everything, low unemployment, low inflation, big spending, low taxes, we should be skeptical.
Lorraine would certainly suggest a healthy dose of skepticism. There are almost always choices and consequences.
What's another key theme?
The power of expectations. This is huge in modern macroeconomics. What people believe will happen in the future powerfully influences what they do today.
How so? Like with inflation?
Exactly. If everyone expects inflation to be high next year, workers will demand higher wages now, businesses will raise prices now in anticipation. And guess what?
High inflation becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Bingo. This is why central bank communication and credibility are almost as important as the interest rate decisions themselves.
Yeah.
If people trust the central bank to keep inflation under control, their expectations stay anchored, making the bank's job much easier.
Interesting. It's psychological as much as mechanical.
Very much so. Then there's theme three, the non-negotiable reality of globalization.
Right. Especially coming from Chile, he'd feel this acutely.
Absolutely. In the 21st century, no economy is an island. What happens in the U.S. or China affects interest rates, trade flows, and investment decisions everywhere else. Domestic policy always has to consider the global context.
Your local mortgage rate might depend on decisions made halfway across the world.
It often does. And the final big theme Lorraine reinforces is institutions matter more than inputs.
We touched on this with growth, the idea that the rules of the game are critical.
Yes. You can have brilliant technical policies, the best economic models, but if you don't have the underlying institutional software, rule of law, property rights, control of corruption, those policies won't take root or be effective.
It explains why some countries with vast natural resources stay poor, doesn't it?
It's a major part of the explanation. The resources are there, the inputs. But without strong institutions to manage them well and ensure the benefits are shared or reinvested, the wealth often gets wasted or siphoned off.
Lorraine has some really memorable ways of putting these ideas too, doesn't he? Like core takeaways.
Yes, some great lines that really stick. One I like connects the technical side to people's lives. Macroeconomics is ultimately not about abstract models, but about the well-being of people, their jobs, their purchasing power, and their future opportunities.
That really grounds it, makes it human.
And related to that, He frames growth not just as numbers, but as something more profound. Economic growth is not just about producing more goods and services, it's about expanding the possibilities for human flourishing.
So growth as a means to a better life, not just an end in itself?
Right. And he also offers a crucial warning, especially relevant maybe now. The most dangerous phrase in economic policy is, "This time is different."
Oh, I've heard that one.
Because the temptation to ignore fundamental economic relationships has caused so many policy disasters. It's a call to remember history and basic principles. Be skeptical of claims that the old rules don't apply anymore.
Wise words. And what about central bank independence? That's often controversial.
He has a good line on that too, framing it as a practical necessity. Central bank independence is about recognizing that some economic decisions require longer time horizons and technical expertise than the political process typically provides.
So it's not about being undemocratic, but about enabling long-term stability beyond short-term political cycles.
That's the argument, yes. Yeah. Taking the long view.
Okay, so we have the tools, the dynamics, the policies, the themes. How does all this actually help us, the listeners, in everyday life? What are the real-world applications?
Good question. Application one, informed personal financial planning. Understanding the macro environment helps you make smarter decisions.
Like?
Well, if you know the central bank is actively fighting inflation by raising interest rates, you can anticipate that mortgages, car loans, credit card debt will get more expensive.
So maybe you delay a big purchase or lock in a fixed rate if you can.
Exactly. Or you become more focused on earning a real return on your savings, a return that actually beats inflation. Otherwise, your money's losing value, even if the nominal amount grows.
Makes sense. What else?
Application two, smarter civic engagement. The book equips you to actually evaluate the economic promises politicians make.
Cut through the spin.
Yeah. For instance, if a candidate promises huge new spending programs and major tax cuts and insists they'll balance the budget.
Alarm bells should ring.
Based on the principles of fiscal policy and debt we just talked about, yes. You can spot the inherent contradictions much more easily. It helps you ask tougher questions.
And a third application.
Thinking about business and career choices. Understanding the business cycle helps you anticipate shifts in the job market.
How so?
You start to recognize which industries are highly cyclical, meaning they boom in good times but get hit really hard in recessions, like construction or maybe luxury goods, and which are more defensive, steadier regardless of the cycle, like healthcare or essential utilities.
So that knowledge could inform where you look for a job or maybe how you invest, depending on where you think the economy is heading.
Exactly. It adds another layer to your strategic thinking about your career and investments.
So reflecting on the book, what was the most surprising or empowering thing for you?
For me, it really was that blend. Lorraine brings the top-tier academic grounding combined with that gritty, real-world experience as finance minister, especially navigating crises in an emerging market like Chile. It just feels very balanced and practical. You know, it cuts through a lot of the purely ideological noise you often hear.
Yeah, that blend is powerful. For me, I think the biggest thing that stuck was the emphasis on expectations. How much of modern monetary policy and really the economy itself hinges on collective belief and trust.
The psychological side.
Right. It's not just levers and dials. It's about managing a shared narrative. Yeah. That was quite eye-opening.
Definitely. And I think the ultimate takeaway, the most valuable lesson from Lorraine, is that economic outcomes aren't just random. They aren't inevitable fate.
They result from identifiable forces, relationships, and crucially, policy choices.
Choices that can be understood, debated, and potentially influenced, which makes macroeconomic literacy not just interesting, but really a practical necessity for anyone wanting to be an informed participant in today's world.
Lorraine really does give us the keys to unlock that understanding. A vital toolkit indeed. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.